ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass, and there is no Ed Cowan today. But as we have been doing during the winter months, we've had more than suitable replacements, and there's no different on this occasion. A man who's here by popular demand. We put the call out to our audience. We said, look, who are some people we should get on? And you wouldn't believe the amount of people that replied saying we should get Adam Voges on the podcast, and that's exactly what we've done. He's a man who averaged over 60 with the bat in Test cricket. And then he only went on and became the most successful coach in WA cricket history, and leading the Mighty Warriors, as I still call them, to three consecutive titles in the Sheffield Shield, plus a boatload of Big Bash titles. He's still the coach of the Perth Scorchers, the current champions, of course, as well as a bunch of other gigs that we're going to get into as well with the man himself. Adam, appreciate your time.
Thank you, Corbin. Thanks for that very kind introduction. I'm not sure how true it is about the request, but I'm very happy to be here, Matt.
No, absolutely. We can show you the emails. We've got proof. We had Ryan Harris on a few weeks ago. We've spoken to George Bailey and Todd Greenberg and so many people over the last couple of weeks that are front and centre in Australian cricket, and you're certainly one of those. What are you doing nowadays? So you've got stints in various competitions all around the world, but you're just about to fly out to the US to go and coach the Seattle Orcas. We love following a little bit of Major League Cricket here, but how many different gigs have you got at the moment in world cricket?
Yeah, it's an exciting time, I guess. At the back end of last season, I finished up as the West Australian coach after 8 years, and a few of these opportunities have been able to present. So, as you mentioned, I'm flying out to the US to be part of MLC Major League Cricket Season 4 with the Seattle Orcas, which I'm really looking forward to. That'll run through June and July. Then I'll pop over to the UK and be part of the Trent Rockets coaching staff as well in the 100 competition as well. So yeah, really looking forward to that. Still be very much in orange and the Scorchers during our home summer, but a couple of new, I guess, opportunities and a couple of new challenges ahead, which I'm looking forward to.
I'm keen to ask you all about the things that you hate talking about, which is yourself and everything that you've done in the game. So I'll embarrass you with a bunch of questions about everything you've achieved. But first of all, just a holistic approach, like playing versus coaching. How do you find are they equally rewarding? Are they different? Like, how does it fulfill you as someone that's been around cricket your whole life? Now, when you're not actually the one out there doing it with the batter in the field, but you're still obviously hands-on in a coaching capacity. How do they compare?
I've probably got some recency bias with coaching, obviously, and the experiences that I've had as opposed to being a player. As a player, you're obviously, there's plenty of self-interest and you want yourself to do well and your team to do well. As a coach, there's a much broader, perspective and role involved in that. And I guess that maybe potentially brings you more satisfaction as well, just to see young players start to be able to achieve some of their goals and dreams that they're hoping to be able to do, and then to be able to help them have team success and individual success and get to where they want to is certainly something that's very satisfying to me. But you ride the ups and downs as a player and as a coach. They're both equally rewarding, I think.
You mentioned 8 seasons as coach of the state team with WA. Obviously, that three-peat was the highlight, but you won one-day titles, and we'll get to the Scorchers aspect of it all, which obviously you've had plenty of success there with 3 titles and being the most recent champs. But why did you decide to step away from the WA gig after 8 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it just felt from a timing perspective right. 8 years is a great stint, and I've loved every minute. I feel very lucky and privileged to have been able to coach West Australia for that period of time, and for us to have a little bit of success along the way has been terrific. But I guess personally and professionally, I felt that it was time to try something different and to I guess challenge myself in different environments, to work with some different people as well, and go out and explore a bit more of world cricket and see what else is out there. So it wasn't an easy decision. Like I say, I've loved every minute being the West Australian coach, and so that wasn't an easy decision to walk away from that. But to still be part of the Perth Scorchers and to still be part of Big Bash cricket is something that I'm still very excited about.
Is it fair to say it's a very different role, being a state coach to being a coach of a T20 team, for example, which is short term, everyone gets together, you try and put it all together in a short period of time in franchise cricket, whereas, you know, state coaching, you're with these guys day in, day out for 8-9 months of the year. How different is it as a coaching exercise to lead a franchise team as opposed to the 6 state programs that we have here, obviously, in Australia?
Yeah, it is different, no doubt. I think you mentioned day in, day out in a state program, that ability to see the progress and development of players over that period of time, to work with them on a daily basis, is, from a coaching perspective, I think ultimately very rewarding to be able to do that. Franchise cricket is the exact opposite. I think at Seattle, we will get the bulk or the whole of our squad together 2 days before our first game. And so that ability to try and bring a group of people together that come from different backgrounds, different cultures, different environments to try and get them together, to then become cohesive in such a short space of time is a great challenge and something I'm looking forward to.
Have you had a chance to be reflective at all now that you finished up with WA and think 8 seasons, right, I took over this team. They hadn't won a Sheffield Shield title in 23 years. We won 3. We won 4 ODI titles or One Day Cup titles. And then obviously the amount of guys that have gone on to represent Australia. Have you had a moment at least to look back and go, wow, that's been a pretty crazy journey?
Yeah, I think I've had a small moment. I think as probably players and coaches, we're not very good at doing that, self-reflecting at times. And I guess just having this little bit of time now to look back on the 8 seasons and I guess following in Justin Langer's footsteps and the really strong foundation that he'd been able to provide, the early challenges of, I guess, stepping straight into coaching from being a player and the challenges that brought, and certainly there were some great learnings early on in my career. And then I guess to then continue to grow, help our program grow, and then for us to have that success that we did through the middle there was really rewarding. And I guess you take a small moment to reflect on that, but equally you've always got one eye, I guess, looking forward as to what's coming up next as well.
You know how much I love WA cricket. I mean, I went from being a kid sitting on the hill at the WACA ground looking at the scoreboard as a youngster to then really my first role in the media. I was lucky enough to cover your teams that you played in, obviously, for WA cricket and with Minnow at Sport FM and Community Radio, and then ultimately lucky enough to be here at the ABC and watch from afar. But my heart broke for you as a player, where I felt like you couldn't have given more to the WA program, and yet it felt like there was this black cat that was running around the whacker, and no matter who came along and how good the team looked on paper, you were never able to put it all together, and it felt like there was somehow some greater forces at work or some curse that was on the place for 20-odd years. What changed? What lifted? How did you get rid of that burden with this group to be able to break through and win it and then go on and not just, you know, break through but have sustained success?
Yeah, I guess 23 years is a long time, isn't it, between drinks, as they say. And I think I played for 16 of those 23 years. And
nice.
I think the closest we got was a Shield final down in Tassie where we had a draw against Victoria. But, I think Justin needs to take a lot of credit. He built a really solid foundation at the back end of my career and being able to work really closely with him before he then went on to take on the Australian role was I learned a lot during that period, and I think that his philosophies, while I think we're different personalities, I think our philosophies are relatively similar in terms of how we go about our coaching. And so to be able to continue on the good work that he did. And then I think with most sports and teams, you get to a sweet point where you've got a critical mass of players that have played together for a period of time. And we've had that senior group of players that have probably played together for nearly 10 years. They know each other really well. They understand their games really well. You sprinkle in some talented youth and some energy in between that, and it made for a pretty good mix. And I guess once we were able to achieve that record breaking or the drought, breaking the drought with that first Shield win, probably just gave us that confidence and belief that that was perhaps the start of something. And yeah, fortunately, over the next couple of years, we were able to really cash in on I guess, having that group together.
So we know, obviously, the name brand guys that were part of that go on to represent Australia. Are there any guys behind the scenes that are worth shouting out where you think, gee, this guy doesn't get enough shine that he deserves in that playing group for being, I guess, one of the glue guys that can hold it all together?
If you look back at those teams that won the 3 Shields in a row, I think Sam Whiteman was someone who was absolutely pivotal. He scored hundreds in 2 of the Shield finals. He captained the 2 Shield finals after taking over from Sean Marsh. I think he had a really important role to play. I mean, Joel Parrish, Matt Kelly, Hilton Cartwright, these are the guys that have played together for long periods of time and were able to stick together. They came through under JL. I think he taught them what hard work really looked like, and they've then been able to really, I guess, showcase and drive those behaviours throughout the whole playing group, and the younger players have then seen those examples and they understand what those standards look like as well. So they're just a couple of guys, obviously, for Sean Marsh to captain a Shield final winning team at the back end of his career was really special as well. So, yeah, there's some good memories there.
Absolutely. Mate, it's such a fascinating program. I spoke to Ryan Harris a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned to him that felt like there were similarities between South Australia and WA for a long period of time, not just the droughts, but there were also, you know, figures in and around WA cricket that wanted it to work so badly, but sometimes struggled to get new voices in, and there were all these complicating issues. And particularly in states like that where, you know, the population pool, for example, is a little bit smaller, so then there's tension with the grade cricket clubs about, you know, importing guys from other states as opposed to using local players, and WA cricket is really unusual too for a relatively small population. It has like 16 teams in the first grade competition, which to me feels like a whole lot of teams, and I'm sure that's something that's not going to get solved overnight. But how did you deal with that? I guess the push and pull of, you know, homegrown talent and also importing players, and then also trying to satisfy that the grade cricket clubs. It feels like this is a problem for every level of cricket, the grade cricket clubs to the state level to the national team. How did you go trying to placate that in your time?
Yeah, it's a good question, and yeah, we look a little bit different to what South Australia have done, and Ryan's done a wonderful job there and deserves the great credit for the success they've had in recent times. But, yeah, I think we've very much taken an approach where we wanted to back our local talent in. You always need to fill the occasional gap, and we were able to do that. But, yeah, that real sense of developing within has been strong over our period of time. And to be able to do that, you need to try and work really closely with your premier clubs, and it's tricky in a busy schedule and a packed summer to actually get down and have those relationships with a lot of the premier clubs is never an easy thing to do, but it's managing that relationship, but also obviously managing up with Cricket Australia and understanding where your players sit in the national scheme of things, and then hopefully being able to deliver more and more West Australians in international teams, which is ultimately what we were trying to do as well. So it's a juggle. It's a managing act that you have to do on a daily basis. But I guess WA cricket has been my passion since I was able to pick up a cricket bat. So for me, it's never felt like work really. It's just about this idea of how do I keep helping WA cricket be as strong as possible and working with the key stakeholders within that.
How do you think Bo Casson's going to go?
He'll do great. I'm really excited that Bo's got the opportunity. He's a wonderful coach. I've seen it firsthand for the last 6 or 7 years that he's been part of our WA program. And we're different thinkers. And that's what I loved about him as an assistant coach, because he challenged my thinking as well in the way that we go about it. And he'll do a wonderful job. So I look forward to watching on from afar. If he ever has any questions and he wants to come ask, my phone's always on for him. But he'll do great, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it all plays out.
How will he differ from you? I guess personality types, and I guess what should we expect with Bo as a senior coach of a state team?
Yeah, I think that he will challenge the players' thinking, and I guess again, with me there for 8 years, I think players may have got into certain habits and certain trends that I think Bo will break, or he'll at least challenge some of that. And yeah, look, I really look forward to seeing how it plays out. I think his ability to develop young players is a real strength of his as well. So with that young crop of up-and-coming West Australians that we've got within the squad, I really look forward to seeing how they progress under Bo, and but also getting the best out of some of these senior guys that maybe are closer to the end than at the start. But we've seen change with Aaron Hardy now becoming the West Australian Shield captain. There's a little bit of a change in personnel. There's been challenges with a couple of guys coming back on off CA contracts that perhaps we weren't expecting. So there's been a couple of early challenges for him. But, yeah, like I said, he'll do some really good things. He'll challenge the guys, and I look forward to seeing how it goes.
You've got a couple of very talented guys in that squad, obviously, and we've seen them be highly touted and already pulled into national squads, like Marlik Beardman, for example. What's he capable of, as for people that are probably learning about him for the first time?
Yeah, I think some of us who watched the Big Bash probably saw Marley, bit of a breakout season throughout the last campaign, and after us giving a small opportunity the year before. And the sky's the limit for Marley. He's still very young, and I think there'll still be some challenges with his body over the next period of time, over the next couple of years. But I think as he continues to grow, mature, strengthen that body into a hardened ability to be able to perform day in, day out, I think it's pretty exciting what Marley can do. He can bowl at pace. He's incredibly skillful. He reminds me of a young Jai Richardson in terms of just pure skill. And then obviously he's got the athleticism and speed to go with it. So, he's on the way back from injury again at the moment. But, yeah, if he gets a clean run at it, I think he's pretty exciting.
The guy that everybody in the pub's talking about, it feels like everyone's got an opinion on Cam Green. The curious case of Cam Green. It feels like Mitch Marsh lived it, Shane Watson lived it, the sort of role of the all-rounder and the guy that's seemingly the golden boy in the Australian team, and whether the production matches the opportunities at this stage of his career. But, I mean, we obviously know at his best what he's capable of. He's got multiple hundreds away from home in Test cricket already. What do you see when you look at Cam at this stage of his cricketing journey?
Yeah, again, you mentioned Mitch and Shane Watson, and I guess maybe the unrealistic expectations perhaps that we have of genuine all-rounders within our Test setup. But the reality is there's not too many blokes that can do what Greeny can do. To be 6'7", to be able to bowl 140 k's an hour and to average over 50 in first-class cricket with the bat is pretty special in its own right. And I understand that he perhaps hasn't nailed opportunity here in Australia in Test cricket, and I guess that's what a lot of our viewing public see is the Australian Test team in our home summer. And so, Cameron Green's far too good a player to not have success in the long run. And I understand there's been some frustration along the way, but he can balance teams and he can do things that other players just can't do. And he will show that. I've got absolutely no doubt. And again, clearly I'm very biased because I get to see him close up and more regularly than most. But he has shown that he is a world-class player. I know he'd love to do it a bit more consistently than what he has, but he will. When that time comes, we're all going to be really thankful that we've persisted with him. He's a world-class player.
He's way too good for Shield cricket. We see every time he goes back, he brains them there. I was lucky enough to be in Wellington when he got that 100 at the Basin. And it's fascinating, isn't it? You think you score 100 in New Zealand away from home, you score 100 in India, which are arguably greater achievements than scoring runs in your own backyard. And yet if he had the 200s in Australia, it might just relieve some of the pressure on him from the general public, as you say, that sort of seasonally tune in during the summer months. How do you get the best out of him? What do you think he is? Is he a six that bowls a little bit? Can he bat four? I know there was a report saying he's even been considered possibly as an opener, talking about that Shane Watson follow-on. Where do you think he's best suited in the lineup?
I think he's a number four. I think that's where he's done all his best work in Western Australia. And even his journey to get to the Test team has been a bit of a unique one, in that I think when he debuted for Western Australia, he batted at eight and we played him as a bowler. He actually broke down with stress fractures during that year, but made 100 batting at eight. And so we batted him at four for the rest of the season that year, and he's never looked back since there. But I think he's a number four. I think he's good enough to bat at number four. He can bat four, five or six, really, but I think four is his position. When Steve Smith does retire, I think he's ready-made to go into that position. And he can bowl you 10 overs and innings and have an impact during those 10 overs and really balance what your Test team looks like. And if you find spot for him and Beau Webster in the short term, then obviously you've got plenty of options. But I think, long-term, Cameron's a number four who will score Test hundreds. And then, he can obviously have that impact with the ball as well.
So you keep the Perth Scorchers role, Adam. You're going to continue on doing that at least for another season. You're obviously the reigning champs. You've won that three times. You've done that for 8 seasons already. And as you said, you're going to have coaching stints, obviously, in the 100, and you're the senior coach at the Seattle Orcas coming up in the MLC. I know the job's not available at the moment, but if the national coaching job does become available and Andrew McDonald moves on for whatever reason, I imagine you would be a short price favourite to get the gig. Is it something that motivates you? Is that something that you want to do one day?
Firstly, I don't think Andrew's gone anywhere anytime soon. He's done a wonderful job leading the Australian team, and I would imagine that job's his for as long as he wants it to be. In terms of my career, I'm just really excited about this next change and what that looks like for me over the next 12 months, 24 months. And I guess part of that decision-making to go and explore these things is to try and continue to build my coaching skills in different environments so that if one day the opportunity to be an international or an international coach comes along, that I'm as well prepared as I can be. So it never guarantees anything in life in professional sport, as we know, but I guess for me, it's just about continuing to learn, continuing to apply my trade in different environments, and that's really the focus over the next year or two, and hopefully can continue to do that well, continue to enjoy what I'm doing. That'll sort of be the focus.
There's a lot going on in Australian cricket at the moment. It feels like the noisiest off-season as such that we've had for a long period of time, and we obviously know cricket's a 12-month of the year sport, but certainly in Australia, it does feel like it has sort of dormant periods as the footy codes come sweeping through. But the main reason for that has been obviously the privatisation discussion, and it's long been a bit of a dirty word in Australian sport, privatisation. We haven't had a whole lot of successful stories over the journey. Is it good for cricket, do you think, privatisation in the Big Bash?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know is the simple answer. I think I'm accepting of the fact that it probably will happen at some stage, and appreciate that the pause button's been hit a little bit at the moment, and hence a lot of the discussion around it. I honestly don't know whether it is good or not, but I think it will happen, and I guess I'm open to the idea of it happening. World cricket has changed so much over the last 5 years. Where we are in the next 5 years, I'm not too sure, but What we do need to ensure is that Australian cricket and Cricket Australia, we continue to be able to lead the way, be able to have really strong domestic competitions that attract the best players, so that we can ultimately be the second best franchise competition behind the IPL. And if that's the goal, then privatisation probably does make sense, but time will tell, I guess.
You've consulted in the IPL, you're coaching in the MLC, you obviously have involvement now with the Trent Rockets in the 100 coming up. It feels like WA cricket, along with Vic cricket, are as close to the front of the queue as any of the states in terms of wanting to pursue privatisation. Given your broad global experience in this space, have you been asked by WA cricket as to, hey, what are the pros and cons? What's this going to look like if we went down that path?
I've had conversations with John Stevenson, the WA CEO, with Kate Harvey, and WA's made its position clear that we're open to privatisation and what that looks like. The Scorchers are one of the most successful franchises in the Big Bash. We got a wonderful supporter base that comes and packs out Optus Stadium in the Sea of Orange each home fixture. And the idea of opening that up to private investment is something that I can see both sides of the argument for. But ultimately, what we just need to do is what is actually best for the game and continuing to grow the game and continuing to grow the Big Bash. And so that's the ultimate question. And like I said with my first answer, whether privatisation is the right thing or not, I actually don't know.
I'm still coming to terms with the fact they're not the Warriors, and now all of a sudden the Scorchers are in. They could be privatised owners. Could be the Titans, could be anything. Who knows when some privatised owner comes into the competition. They're all the big questions that are obviously around the corner. The differences between coaching long-form cricket, so red ball cricket, and obviously which you've done with the Sheffield Shield side and the shortest version of the game, how does it change as a coach on match day? I mean, Ed and I debate this a lot, where it feels like in T20 cricket, you have much more power in terms of being a tactical coach, but the game obviously moves quicker. Which one do you feel like you have more control over as a puppet master as such, and moving the chess pieces as a senior coach on match day?
That's a good question. I think they're just different. Like you say, T20 cricket happens so fast. Decision-making needs to be made in a moment's time. First-class cricket, longer-form cricket, you've got a little bit more time to think about things, to tactically work through what your options are. BBL cricket, T20 cricket, you've just got to try and stay a ball ahead of what's actually happening out in the middle. Again, philosophically, for me as a coach, I entrust my captains a lot game days to be able to make some really good decisions out in the middle. And I feel my job is to give them and help them be as prepared as they possibly can be to help make those decisions out in the middle. So I'll back them and what they do. We'll always review how we go about things and how we can learn and be better prepared for the next opportunity that comes along. But yeah, in terms of actual game day and the decisions that get made, a lot of that responsibility then falls back to the captains, and my job really is to support them as opposed to trying to tell them what to do.
T20 cricket, well, everyone's always obviously looking for trends in the game and what's working and what's not, and obviously the meeting of the best players in the world in the IPL is always a pretty good clue to that. We had Matt Roller on from ESPN Cricket Info a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke about win the power play, win the game. It felt like it had never been more true than this year's IPL, that if you were on top early, and we even saw the Gujarat Titans sort of do something a little bit different where they would bowl their two frontline bowlers three overs each during the power play and essentially say, look, let's do that, let's throw Rabada and Siraj at them and burn six, basically three of their overs each up front in that first six overs period, just to try and jump on top. Does it feel that way to you that the power play has never been more important in modern T20 cricket than it is right now?
It's amazing how we go through different trends, isn't it? And the game continues to present these trends. It wasn't too long ago that it was win the middle, win the game, win the spin battle and squeeze through the middle. And if you're able to win that period of the game, then that was seen as the real deciding factor. And we've gone back to that, with the field restrictions, how can we make sure that we're trying to maximise output? And I always think that the IPL is a slightly different game to every other game. With the impact sub player, you're effectively playing 12, teams bat deeper. We've never seen more 200-plus runs scored. Totals get chased down. It just feels like a slightly different game. But equally, you see these trends and no doubt what we have seen and what we certainly tried to do at the Scorchers this year was we needed to put more pressure early on. And with Finn Allen and with Mitch Marsh at the top of the order, we had the personnel to be able to. I reckon there were a few opposition teams that would see Finn and Mitch walk out at the start of the innings. And I reckon that would have taken up a fair bit of their planning meeting the day before. But that idea of being able to, throw the first punch in the power play to really try and take control of that, and then set your innings up from there. No doubt that's a trend that's certainly emerged over the last couple of years.
Are you pro the power surge, or would you rather the sort of six up front like we get in the international game?
I don't mind the surge. I think it just adds a different element to the game. I think it adds a different element to what your middle order looks like, and players that are able to really navigate that period well. So I don't mind it. It almost feels like because the Big Bash, we've had it in for so long now, going back to a six-over power play in the MLC will feel a little bit different for me when we get over there. But you almost feel like in some games of cricket, you almost know which way the result's going to play out. The power surge, I think, just keeps you guessing a little bit in the back end of an inning. So, I've always liked it. But having said that, we don't play it in international cricket, so there's always the argument for, well, maybe our domestic competition should mirror international cricket, but I don't mind it.
If Alistair Dobson comes to you and says, hey, Adam, we're thinking about introducing the super sub the same way they have in the IPL, the impact player, would you say that's a good idea, or would you say, oh, I'm not so sure about that?
Well, we tried that, didn't we, a couple of years ago. We tried bringing in
the X factor,
albeit different parameters. Yeah. I don't think we ever actually used it, which probably would tell you what I thought about that rule, but... Yeah, look, if it was in line with what the IPL do, I guess unless we're going to do it in international cricket, I'm not as sold, which is probably counterproductive to what I've just said about the power surge. But, I think there's always ways to continue to try and innovate, continue to try and build a product that you've got. Like I said, the IPL feels like a different product because of that particular rule. And so, yeah, look, if that's the way that the global game continues to trend, then I'm open to exploring it again. But I'm pretty happy with our product as it is as well.
And the other thing that we've got, not so much an issue, but certainly we got trend lines in every T20 competition anywhere in the world over the last few years, is that the team that bats second more often than not wins, which we're starting to get to a stage where you think, gee, how much of this is sort of predetermined given whoever wins the toss has such an inbuilt advantage. What do we do about that as a sport, do you think, that we can try and add a little bit more jeopardy rather than the side that batting first has such an advantage, batting second has such an advantage?
Yeah, no, even that's changed over the last couple of years as well. And we talked about trends and power plays and that sort of stuff. It wasn't that long ago that, no, you had to bat first because runs on the board and building pressure and being able to win the game that way was seen as the preferred method. And I guess what I mean, in the Big Bash, we had to do it differently this year because Ashton Turner lost 9 bat flips in a row. So we were batting first more times than not. But in 5 of those games, we were able to put 200 plus run totals on the board. We were able to win the game that way. But it's certainly a trend that no doubt you can tell the players prefer. They prefer to know what they need to do. They prefer to let the opposition team bat first to work out the conditions and understand the conditions a little bit better. How do you change that? Do you get rid of the toss? Do you find a different way to decide who actually bats first? Yeah, if the trend is so strong with the chasing team winning, maybe there are ways that we can explore what that looks like. Because, we actually genuinely talked about someone else going out and doing the bat flip at one stage because AT could not get one right.
Did he not have any backyard experience, like roofs or flats? Like, was he calling both ways or surely you go roofs, don't you?
I don't know. I actually don't know what he was doing, but whatever it wasn't working.
Yeah. All right, last one on this front. So that the BBL, the way the calendar is currently constructed, obviously means that the test players or the frontline international guys aren't available for large periods of the Big Bash. And then this year there's going to be, you know, the Tour of India, which obviously is going to exclude them for the back end of the tournament. If Cricket Australia said, hey, we want our best players available, but it means we're either going to have to move key test matches in the holiday period, or we're going to have to move the Big Bash to a different window. Would you be for that to make sure that the top guys were there?
Yeah, I would. I think if we it should be a priority to try and get our best players playing in the Big Bash as much as we can. And what that compromise looks like, I'm not entirely sure. Clearly, during the school holidays is peak time. It's when our international window is as well. Even as a player, you'd often see the Big Bash when it ran into February. You knew exactly when school went back in different places because the drop-off in crowds was pretty significant during that time. And so whether we can cram more cricket into shorter windows to then create some more availability, perhaps that's an option. I don't know if there is a perfect fix, but I think it still needs to be a priority that we have our best players playing.
Adam, all the very best coming up at the MLC. Ed Cowan, who I do this podcast with every week, it raves about Major League Cricket. Basically says, hey, we talk about sleeping giants in the sport. It feels like this is the thing that could become the second best T20 league in the world overnight. What is it about it? What makes it special as a T20 comp?
Yeah, well, as Ed and many have said, I think it is a sleeping giant in terms of the ability to build the game in such a large market. And look, trying to sell 4 or 5 weeks in America to players isn't that hard to sell, yeah, to be honest. So we're getting good players. We're getting good overseas players. I think if they can continue to build pathways to keep helping the domestic players continue to improve, so the product continues to improve, then that only makes it stronger. I believe that there's going to be more teams entering into the competition as well. And as that growth continues to happen, the facilities continue to improve, then I think it can be a really, really great product. And, we're building towards that. But, yeah, like I said, getting people over 4 or 5 weeks is it's not a tough sell.
If you're looking for any broadcasters, more than happy to come hang out in Seattle as well. It feels like there's a lot of people queuing up for all of that. Seattle Mariners, they're the baseball team, aren't they, in that area? They'll be playing some games at the same time. Have you had any crossover with them yet?
No, not yet. I've decided I'm a Mariners fan now, but yeah, so I've been watching them a bit closer and... Yeah, it's we're right in the thick of the baseball season at the moment, so hoping to get to a couple of games while we're there.
I was about to say, just chalk it down to some personal development or something like that. You senior coaches are the best at that, at getting in some various clubhouses around the world. Adam, congratulations on all you achieved with WA Cricket. Appreciate your time, as always, chatting us through it. Good luck with the Orcas and the Scorchers and the Rockets and everything that's ahead. I'm sure we'll see you in and around Australian cricket in the not-too-distant future, I'm sure. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Gordon. Thanks for the chat. Cheers.